Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello!
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show. It is episode 109. And it's a great delight to speak to you. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And you are heavy with cold. And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Crime.
Suspense.
Thrillers.
And mysteries. Welcome to the show. Our guest this week is Abby Osborne, writing as Abigail Osborne.
Yes.
And it's one of those interviews where we just had so much fun. We found a kindred spirit. She speaks to us from her home, rather, in Worcestershire, in Worcester, in fact, the city of Worcester. And it was just a terrific interview. She's published by Bloodhound Books and psychological fiction author.
Yes, and I've already recommended to anyone I've spoken to since we interviewed Abby to listen to the next podcast because it's a brilliant one. I don't know what it... I mean, they're all brilliant. Of course they are, and they all have something different. But there was something very... I guess that we could relate to as people and writers, well, hopeful writers and publishers ourselves, yeah. About what we chatted with Abby about. So
yeah, absolutely. So that's coming up later in the program. Well, we want to get into the news as usual, and there's one or two things that sort of touch on stuff that we did last week. Now, I discussed last week about the situation where Findaway Voices, who distribute our Hobeck audiobooks, all 12 of them so far, and indeed some of my own private sort of narration work, have been using a clause which they added to their contracts a couple of years ago to help Apple develop artificial intelligence narration. And it was really hidden under the bonnet in the contracts, which, frankly, the whole narration world was unaware of and has been very, very upset by. And I was contacted by a journalist in the United States for Wired magazine.
You were, yes.
And they've done a brilliant article. I'm not quoted in it, but I gave them some background as to my feelings on the subject. And so Wired have done a great article in this week's edition, and it's headlined, "Audiobook Narrators Fear Apple Used Their Voices to Train AI." And after a backlash, Spotify paused an arrangement that allowed Apple to train machine learning models on some audiobook files. Now, I have withdrawn all support for that and asked them to take it down for
yes,
all of the people who've worked for Hobeck.
We feel very strongly about it,
Very. But, you know, this is the drift in this thing. So check out that article. It's been taken very seriously in the United States, where the union for audiobook narration is the labor union SAG-AFTRA, and they represent recording artists as well as actors and other creatives. And they have forced the two companies to stop using files for union members affected. And that dates back to any files that were being used. Now, that obviously does not bear for anybody in the United Kingdom. So if you are affected by this, please go and look at the contract. It's the very last clause in any Findaway contract, and you can ask them to withdraw your tacit support, your implied, implied support for using your narrator's voice or indeed your own voice as part of their machine learning. Because essentially what they're trying to do is put narration out of business.
And that's not good.
No, it's appalling. But that's the way that big tech business is going and where artificial intelligence is going as well, as we've all heard about you know, works of literature being fed into the machine and then asking the machine to come up with something similar to Jane Austen. He's getting better and better at it.
Scarily so, yeah. But we have high hopes that, like with the fear that ebooks would completely wipe out any need for paperbacks, it just won't happen.
It won't, no. Not at this time. But again, it's a value proposition, isn't it? You know, human narration comes at an enormous time consumption and effort and creativity. And I've been in my studio solidly for the past 2-3 weeks working on a contract separate to Hoback. And I've got several more weeks work to do. And it's been not quite all consuming, but you barely see me during the daylight hours because I'm in my studio ploughing through being creative.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of work.
This might sound weird, but it's been quite a quiet time. Mm. It's almost been like I've been in the office by myself a lot of the time.
Yeah, to a degree. But I mean, you know, it's been very good for me in the sense of having that, you know, I have to be disciplined to do this in a sense because it is such a demanding contract. Although I did emerge, two occasions I've emerged pretty much in tears because three central characters got bumped off in the last book I did, the ones I loved doing the voices of. So I've got to create new voices, which is sad. And also, I narrated so much at one point, I came out, I couldn't speak pretty much. I'd given everything I had left for a battle scene that lasted an hour and a half.
For you not to be able to speak was very strange.
Yeah, you were going to say a good thing, but anyway, there we
go. Oh, would I?
Okay, let's touch on some other news then.
there's quite a few things to talk about, actually, and this I've only came across today. We were talking to Abby. One thing we were talking about Abby about was TikTok, because Abby uses TikTok, and she was actually offered to help us if we need any help on how to use TikTok. And I did use it beginning of last year quite a lot, but I just stopped because I couldn't see that it was having any effect.
It wasn't having a lot of traction, was it?
No. So I just thought, oh, it's for the youngsters, and gave it up. But I came across this news item about a thriller writer called Lloyd Devereux Richards. So this is a fairly elderly guy. It was his dream. He spent 14 years writing his book. It was his dream. And it's had brilliant reviews. But the sales just haven't matched up to the reviews. And his daughter felt sorry for him. And she thought, what can I do about this? So she recorded a little 16-second TikTok video just of him sat at his desk looking a little bit sad, holding his book. And it worked.
Yeah.
His sales went up. And she didn't tell him that she'd done this. And he just said he noticed this Amazon ranking go sky high and thought, oh, my dreams have come true.
Oh.
So it's quite sweet. And it is apparently a very good book. So, you know, we were talking about this just now and you said, oh, that's pulling on the heartstrings. And
well, I guess that's, as you rightly pointed out, that's what a lot of advertising does do, and marketing. So
I don't mind if it's a good product.
No, and quite. Yeah, no, you're right. Well, that's a lovely little story. How about the darker side of TikTok as I would see it? There's another story you've
found. Yeah, so this was in the bookseller, and the article was looking at how traditional publishers use TikTok, or started to use TikTok, because TikTok originally was for young people posting daft videos, still is very much for that. But authors started using it to promote their own books, and readers and reviewers, people who love books, were using it to promote books they had read. And apparently now traditional publishers are looking at who are getting the most views on TikTok in the independent author community and making them offers for contracts for publishing with them. And I think it makes sense, doesn't it? If they are looking for the next big thing, and there are some very successful independent publishers out there
who
are outpacing people published by traditional publishers by, you know, tenfold, hundredfold, why wouldn't they do this?
Well, yes, okay, why wouldn't they? But why should they? And is it right? I'm pretty conflicted by this.
Yeah.
You know, it's again, in a similar way to you've heard of quite a number of successful indie authors who've sold independent of, being published, they do it themselves, being signed up by big publishers in recent years, in recent months, in fact. And they're doing the same thing by looking at TikTok. And yes, I mean, it just stinks to me. I'm sorry, but it just does. And it feels cynical. It feels... It's a shortcut for the publishers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is.
They don't support the ones they got. They don't allow them time to develop. They don't invest in them enough. They just go for the shortcut. And I think that's sad, really.
But then, again, the author themselves, they can say no. They don't have to say yes to a contract.
I'd appreciate that, yes, I do.
I think it's still, despite how successful the independent writing community is, it's still a dream of most of them, I think, to have a contract with someone like HarperCollins.
Yes, absolutely. I understand that. But isn't it the same phenomenon of the publishers in the last 2 years signing up, and I'm going to get myself in hot water here, but realizing they have a diversity problem and chasing anybody diverse and publishing them, isn't it the same as their really quite craven drive to get celebrities to write books in different genres? It's another extension of that same behavior.
Yes, because they are a business and their aim is to make money.
Right. I understand that. It just stinks. I'm sorry, but it's not authentic, it's not organic, and it's not long-term planning and backing people. It is just simply jumping on the bandwagon again. And so I don't find that... I'm not comfortable with it, as you can hear.
No. And yes, I'd share your view in some respects. I think...
You're doing a good job of explaining the way they would be thinking. And look, none of us are stupid, or naive enough not to know that's what they're thinking. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that I personally feel comfortable with it or think it's a good thing.
No, I think if they can prove that they are putting that person's interest first, they're thinking of helping that person find more readers. It's the same with the diversity thing. If they see an author with talent and they happen to be from underrepresented background, and they're thinking this person's voice needs to be heard for their voice.
No,
that's fine.
Not what they're thinking. That's not what that's not what the need was when they did this. They were shamed into sorting out themselves out and getting the balance, improve the balance in terms of their authors, and that's something obviously that we need to look at too. But at the same time, they are they have just jumped on every bandwagon possible.
I agree.
In that sphere.
That's why I want them to prove that wasn't their motive. There wasn't the bandwagon.
No, it was their motive. It's just that, if they are genuinely going to support people and whatever else, great. But I don't get that impression. I think it's just a rush to tick boxes. I'm sorry. That's what I really think's happening for most of those major publishers. And I don't think it's doing anybody any favours, frankly.
No, okay, fair enough.
Okay, I feel very passionately about that. Should we get to the interview?
Well,
have you got another story?
Well, the only other thing is, the Nibbies, long list of the Nibbies, which is actually related.
Right, let's explain what they are. That's the National Book Awards in the UK. The Nibbies is that for short.
Yes. So they've released...
And we ought to say that we have a vested interest in this because we did put ourselves forward for the small press category, and we were overlooked for the Midlands area.
Yeah, and we were gutted.
It was, the sort of, it was one of those things where for a few hours, I had that feeling of, what's the point? It felt really disappointing, and we'd put together you put together a very imaginative submission, and, it was disappointing because, frankly, the same old names turned up.
Yeah, there was two people who were there last year on the list.
And not all of them were actually, they were publishing services companies as opposed to publishers.
Yeah, I don't understand why people who provide publishing services as their main business can be in a category for small press. I would have thought small press would have to be traditionally published.
Yeah, and I would also question, I mean, you know, I'm not going to name names, but some of the small presses that were in that list across the country are very, very big presses. They're not small. They've sold millions of books, and they have an army of traditional, very established figures from big companies who've set up whatever company, and they're in the small press. That is just a nonsense, frankly. Mm. An absolute nonsense. So, yeah, okay, you just say, please don't be bitter about it. But well, it did hurt.
It really did hurt. It hurt me as well. I remember I went to do the school run straight after we found out, and I was in silence most of the time because I was in shock almost because I thought, why?
Yeah.
We're fantastic. Why?
Yeah, that's another
But it's hard, isn't it? And then you start looking at the people who did get selected and being a bit like, well, but their website isn't as nice as ours, or they haven't got a cat, or. But on the positive side, they've since also released the finalists for the independent bookshop, and they've got more bookshops on the list than usual, and some that we know about and we've encountered. So,
Bookworms and Dragon Tales over in Norwich.
Yes, and Burt's Books as well, which I see a lot of activity on Facebook and a number of others as well. So that was quite cheering, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to knock all of it, but, you know, it just that stung, actually. That really did.
But we will try again next year because every time I get bashed down, I want to get up and try again.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to prove people wrong. Anyway, let's get to the interview.
Yes.
With Abby Osborne. And we're blown away by this interview. We just loved it. And we also explain, Abby has written and published a number of books with Bloodhound, which are sort of standalone psychological fiction novels. Great, great books. But her background, and she runs her own small business, advising particularly in the education sector, but also in business, how to make adaptations for people with disabilities and neurodiversity issues. And this is, you know, her area of expertise. So we talked a lot about that area of her, you know, experience, but also her writing methods and all sorts of things came out. And it was just one of those really fun and varied interviews. And, you know, just, and her writing method is, I mean, I think it's the first person we've ever spoken to who writes everything in the order that she feels fits on the day.
Yeah, so she follows her emotions, basically, rather than
absolutely
chronologically.
Yeah, no, it was really, really terrific. And we just had so much fun. So let's talk to Abby Osborne. What a great pleasure it is to speak to Abby Osborne. Welcome to the show.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And we're always excited to meet new people to us and, you know, members of the author community. So, Abby, tell us your journey to becoming an author. It was inspired by meeting someone else, another author, who twisted your arm and said, look, you should go for it.
I'm sure she didn't twist your arm. Like, you're
no, she could have, to be fair. I absolutely love her writing. I would accept any kind of interaction from her because she's brilliant. But yeah, no, I was doing book reviews originally. I reviewed Caroline Mitchell's one of her earlier novels, and she just happened to contact me and said, like, thank you for the review. It was really well written. Have you thought about writing, because it is very well written, and I've never ever considered it up until that point, really. But I was actually in a job that was I had loads of free time, which sounds amazing but is actually really boring, because my friends were working and my husband was out at work, and I was just kind of like this ghoul haunting my own house with not much to do. So I just that just sparked something, and I just gave it a go, and then that led me to this, which I could never have predicted.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because one of our book bloggers, our regular book bloggers, he's an ex-accountant. I don't know if he listens to the podcast, but he writes the most amazing blogs. I think they should be in The Guardian. They're brilliant. And I keep saying, you need to write a book. Mm. So it can happen like that, you know, you can.
Who are we talking about?
Pete Fleming,
I thought you meant. No, that's brilliant. So, I mean, When was that exchange with?
Gosh, it'd be about 2014, 2015, something like that.
I thought you
could
say 20 years ago then.
Oh, no. No, nearly. No, it's no, it was about 2014, 2015, I think it would have been. And yeah, I've always loved books. I've always read, but I've always been held back thinking I just don't have the imagination. I wouldn't be able to do it. And it's never something that I've ever thought. I've always thought of writing as quite an elitist career, not something anybody can just do. That's what my misconception used to be, that so I just gave it a try, and I'm so happy that I did. But yeah, it was never something I've always wanted it to be since I've grown up, because I never thought I could do it, so I never even entertained it.
Do you know, that's quite interesting. That's not the first time we've heard that from a writer we've interviewed on the podcast, this idea that you have to be perhaps university educated anyway, or just be of a certain person.
Well, I think there's an element of that. I think there's also a geographical element as well. I think a lot of people assume that you've got to be hanging out
in Clapham.
In London, which is a reference to our guest last week, in Julie Anderson, who was in Clapham and leading Clapham Writers.
Just live in Clapham.
Yeah,
it's like every other house.
But I do think that the further away from London you get, the more difficult it seems to be to, you know, the perception is that it'll be difficult to get published.
But it's getting easier now, because of obviously it's so easy to self-publish now, because that's what I did originally. I think back, you would have to really want it to be your passion to put yourself through the rejections and submitting to publishers and stuff, which is why I never, because I didn't know, even when I wrote the first book, The Puppet Master, I didn't know it was going to be what I wanted to do as a career. It was just more, I've written this book, let's see what happens. It wasn't that it was going to be my job, this is what I was going to do. So that's why I self-published and didn't even consider going to the publishers or anything like that at that time. But now it's got so much more accessible, I feel like it is easier to consider it as a career now.
Absolutely. Well, what was that process like for you writing that first book? How difficult was it?
So I started with just kind of looking at things that had happened to me, like my childhood and things that I'd experienced. And then it just kind of escalated from there and transformed. And I started with this small kernel of an idea, writing some recollections, and then all of a sudden this male character Adam was born, and I just got this I can even remember it now, this excitement, sat in my chair in my kitchen just typing these words. And for me, I'm a complete pantser, I make it up as I go. So I didn't know what I was going to type next, and it was so exciting. And then I'd read it back and go, oh, so that's happened. And it was just a really exciting process. So for me, I write very intensively as well. I've got ADHD, so I'm very hyper-focused once I'm in the zone. So I write extremely intensively, and I will just sit there and not move. And that's what I'm like with reading as well. I only enjoy a book if I can sit and read it for the whole, until it's finished. I don't like to dip in and out.
Me.
Yeah. So it's so I write very intensively. So when I wrote The Puppet Master, it only took me about 3 months to write the whole thing, because I just didn't move and did nothing else but that.
That's fascinating. And because I recently had a diagnosis of ADD without the H bit, and so I'm with you on this. I mean, you know, it is a superpower when it's harnessed, but it's I can see now what you're saying about having time on your hands, because procrastination is, you know, you're either one of two things. You're either absolutely focused and you know, nothing can interrupt it, or you are drifting with a million thoughts and nothing happening. And and the only thing that would motivate me at that, when I've had those periods, is watching my watch to make sure I don't miss Holmes Under the Hammer, and then bargain hunt by way of putting some shape on my day. But that's fascinating. And if we could just touch on that, I mean, reflecting, at what stage of your life did you get that diagnosis? Did you recognize that this was
workplaces. I run my own business. I don't write full time. I run my own business doing disability assessments. So I started off doing assessments for students at university. If they have a disability, they can get support. And so I would kind of work out with them what support they needed. So it kind of entered my field then when I was doing assessments for students. But it was only really when I moved into doing it for the workplace and I start in every single ADHD assessment I did, I was like hearing someone talk about my life. And so that was when I realized. So I didn't, because when I went to university, if it wasn't if the lecture wasn't about an essay I was writing, I was counting the ceiling tiles or I was playing with my Game Boy. Like it was, I couldn't focus if it wasn't something that really grabbed me or that I needed to know. And so once I was doing all these assessments for these students in these workplace things, I was like, oh my God, that's me. I can't do that. And so, yeah, so it's later on, I was one of the people that thought ADHD was just, you can't sit still. But I didn't realise that there's the impulsivity, the inattentiveness, like, and the inattentive type, which is what I have got. So it was later for me.
Absolutely. Oh gosh, the echoes are. I used to sit in lectures next to university and try and count the dots on a tile. Or,
I used to play squares.
I used to imagine. Did you?
Yeah, you know that game.
Yeah.
Where you draw a line.
You've got the dots. Yeah.
Yeah. But I used to think if I were to join the dots on that tile, what would it create? Is it, you know, so I do join the dot while, you know, they were blathering on about the first century AD, you know, Roman religion or something. And I just be, it is an extraordinary thing when you find out, and it explains everything, doesn't it? Yes, and especially what you're talking about, the impulsivity. I think this is something that I really have, since I found out, I've been a lot less impulsive, but there's still elements of that. But, you know, but I've got myself in scrapes and all sorts of things just because I'm impulsive. And it is an extraordinary thing. So to, you know, channeling that hyper-focus, it's still not an easy thing to manufacture, if you like, in the sense that when you're we're going to talk about this later, I'm sure, but on your website, you're talking about how you would like to be more a writer than a small business owner and trying to drive yourself that way. It still puts a lot of pressure on you as a person with ADHD to fulfill that promise to yourself and get the focus on a regular basis. How do you do that?
Yeah, it is really hard. Because writing, when I first did it and I did the first book, there was no obligation. It was something I was doing because I was passionate about it. But now I'm doing it because there's an expectation, there's a deadline. And so I do find it hard and I do procrastinate. And so the only way I've got over that is just through the pressure of the deadline. So I write extremely intensively as soon as the deadline gets to the point where I start to feel the fear. And then my productivity just flies through the roof. So that's the only way I found to do it, is to set a concrete deadline. And that then engineers that urgency for me.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
It works on him. I know that.
If I
give you a deadline, you do it.
Yes, that's true. I do need that because I can't impose my own. And I used to have this thing at university where I would have essay crisis every term, and I would literally get to within 3 days of having to hand in 4 pieces of work and only start working on them with 3 days to go. And I'd be on the Pro Plus and staying up all night. And I used to keep a scoreboard on my door in my first year so that people, you know, A, knew not to disturb me, but also I told them how many essays I'd got through it. It became a sort of feature. Everyone would sort of figure out where I was in the process. And I would always be the, you know, literally a minute to go putting those essays in the, in the pigeonholes. So, yeah, it is blessing and a curse, I guess.
It's a superpower, isn't it? You're using it as your superpower in a way, because you recognise that it's an issue that you have, but you're using it to achieve things.
Yeah, because I think you do have to have an element of hyperfocus to be able to produce that volume of words as well, because it is a lot of words. So it does help me in that respect to, especially I find at the beginning it takes me a while, but then once I get into the zone of the story, I can really kind of unleash that hyperfocus and just go with it.
That's terrific. And in terms of your relationship with your publisher now, you're published by Bloodhound.
Yes.
Have you had that discussion with them to explain that's your way of operating, that, you know, if it's going to an editor that they're going to get it, you know, it'll be later rather than sooner, that kind of thing?
They're really flexible with me, to be fair, because I do have autoimmune condition as well, so I have to have these nasty treatments every 6 months. So they're quite flexible with me, like if I needed a little bit of extra time, they'll help with that. But I do kind of work with them and say, look, I need you to give me a deadline, an exact day that you need, an exact day and time. they are really supportive in that respect, to be fair.
That's terrific. So when you got going and you self-published first, what was that experience like? Because
Very impulsive.
Yeah, well,
As I look back on it now, I could produce a guide on how not to self-publish a book, I think, because I wasted so much money. I bought 10 ISBN numbers because somebody said that was better than just getting one. So I now have 8 left for no reason whatsoever. I chose the first editor I saw. I didn't do any research. I didn't know what I was doing. I was basically walking around in the dark going, yes, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that. And so it was a very, it was a very stressful time. But I managed to cobble it together and get like a cover. And I just wish that I'd spent more money in different areas, like on more than one edit and things like that. Things I know now, but I didn't really know at the time. But it was all part of the learning curve is what I think. But I still have to give myself some credit because it did go really well. And that's how I got noticed by Bloodhound, just because I self-published it. And then I put it on special offer for the weekend before I went to Harrogate Crime Writing Festival. And it went up to like number, it went up into like the charts. It was like, I think it was like number 10 in the entire free Kindle store. At one point. So I know it was amazing. So I did really well with it. I was like, I think how much money I'd have made if people had actually bought it though.
we go through that as well when we do special deals.
So I was like, oh man. So it went really well and that got me noticed. And that's when I met the publisher at Bloodhound and they'd seen it because obviously it had been quite visible from that. So I didn't do too bad, but there's a lot of things I wish I could have done differently. And I feel like there's so much information, like so many people telling you how to self-publish, what to do, that it can be so overwhelming to know what you should be doing. Like there's not a clear method. So, and my advice to anyone self-publishing would be just to research and make sure you like don't just impulsively choose people, you like do your proper research and take your time with it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Yeah, and I think you know, even when you're signed up, it's an evolving situation, and one thing that works any given week doesn't work the next.
And also different authors as well, and different books and different genres. So there's so many different levels.
So that level of research and adaptability, I think it applies really when, you know, no matter what platform or method you're getting to publication, you still have to sort of keep your eye on where things are going.
I think I wasn't looking at it as a business when I was doing it. I was doing it, I've written this book, let's see what happens. It wasn't something I was going to do as a career. So that's why I didn't I wasn't very methodical with it and didn't think for the future either. I was just thinking, oh, I'm just going to publish this book, see what happens. Like it wasn't, I'm going to be an author now. So I think that informed what many of the decisions I made.
Mm. Yeah. And creatively, how did that, you know, that experience, how's that fed into what you do now and the method that you use?
In terms of like my writing, do you mean?
Yes. Or... Yeah.
Yeah. My writing process is from when I first wrote that book is pretty much the same. I still make it up as I go along. I tried to plot for this book I'm doing now, and then I ended up coming up with 7 different endings and just sitting on the kitchen floor having a paddy because I was like, I just can't decide which one's the best. So for me, it's just I've realized I work best if it's just completely organic, and it just what I write is what I write, and it just comes out. It's just, I don't know what I'm going to type next. And that's what I love about it. So that's what I need to keep doing.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I think that the plotters out there like us to think that their method is the best one, but it not necessarily is for different people.
It probably is helpful because there is times that I'm sat there thinking, come on, inspiration strike. where are you going? What are you doing? That like, so it can be quite difficult when you don't know where to go, because it is a big, like, you do have to really focus and really think about, like, you just got to unleash your creativity, and that means being in the right mindset and kind of thing. Whereas if you have an idea where it's going, that you've got prompts, so to speak, whereas my prompts are being made up as I go.
I think the best thing to do is get in the car and drive somewhere, because that's when your mind suddenly goes, oh, I've got a great idea.
Yeah, mine's normally when I go to sleep. I then at like 3 a.m. have that idea that I should have gone, oh, I could go that direction. So I've just got loads of garbled notes on my phone that I have to decipher in the morning.
Yeah.
I think 3 a.m., any night, 3 a.m., there's a whole load of artists and writers and musicians. Yeah. They're all lying in bed going, oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, do you know definitely. What? There's a scope for a new social club. Network on that, isn't it?
3 a.m. club, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, that's fascinating. I mean, it is. I mean, I'm glad that they're flexible around deadlines for various reasons, as we've already explained.
It's like us.
Yeah, we are fairly flexible. yeah, have another year to write it, that kind of thing. But it is interesting that there's a positive and negatives there. I mean, we're talking about, you know, that wish sometimes, and I'm the same because of the ADD that, you know, if I'm writing and it's flowing, it's absolutely the best feeling in the world.
Yeah.
But if you then the next day you approach it and it's just not going to happen and you don't know where it's, you know, A, you don't know what direction you're going in, but actually you just don't know where to go with the next scene. And that can be distressing. That's the point where I get jealous of the plotters.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think that's why I don't write in order, when I start writing, because I don't have like a whole story or the characters. I normally have something I want to explore. Like with Save Her, my second one, I wanted to look at friendship, and I knew it was going to be these two women who were friends and kind of like the dangers of obsessive friendship. So I knew that was where I was going, but I had no, that was it. That's all I knew. So I tend to just write random things that occur to me. I'm a very emotional writer. So if I'm in a mood or an argument with my husband, I'll write something really dark, or like or if I'm really happy, I'll write a lighter scene. So I just jump about. So I use Scrivener so I can write out of order, because I can't write it.
I don't think I've ever come across anyone who writes out of order. I love that idea.
I just write what I feel, and then I piece it all together later.
Wow.
That's fascinating. Like a jigsaw.
Yeah. So if I'm, because I feel like sometimes I'll be like, oh, I've got this idea for, I'll have like a sudden light bulb moment of, oh, this would be good to do at the end. And then I'll just be like, oh, do you know what? I'll write something action wise because I feel like writing something like that. So I write for my emotions, and I feel like that makes it more enjoyable because that's the mood I'm in. So I can capture that in the writing, I hope.
Yeah. Well, what about the edit though? I mean, at what stage?
So this is the stage I'm at now. So I've written the first draft of this book, and I now have to read it back through, because obviously I've never read it in order, and I've used Scrivener to put it all into order, and now I have to spend the time adding the filler scenes so that it actually makes sense and connects up and move things around. So it does mean that my second draft edit stage is a lot longer, because it's not just a case of reading it through, it's a case of connecting the scenes and making sure it like flows properly. And so it does mean that my edit takes longer, but I can't write in chronological order. It stunts me. I like to just write what I feel like. I can't do it in order.
Yeah, because I guess you'd lose that writing time if you were there battling to do the next obvious thing that comes in the story. You wouldn't write anything because it wouldn't, you know, because it's a dark scene, but you're happy, so you can't write
exactly.
It, so.
Yeah, that's what it is for me. Yeah, I have to be in that mood to write that scene, and if I'm not, I'll just sit there and play on TikTok.
Well, I don't know if you share my frustration with, because I proudly have. Well, it's more than a shelf now, because they're stacked up on top of each other, of all the books, recent books, and some of the classics about structure and plotting and all that stuff. That, you know, there's a lot of people out there, much like the self-publishing industry, which tells you that, you know, if you follow these maxims that we say you should do, you will be successful. It doesn't necessarily follow that way. It's the same thing with the plotting and the structure side of things. There are lots of books out there that say, for certain types of side of brain, it must make sense, and people can input that thing into Scrivener, create 40 or 50 sort of scene cards, and just go and make that thing happen.
Yeah.
But for those of us who are jump around brains, that stuff is very hard to absorb and then act on, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think it just feel like it just restricts me, and I just I can't do that. I've got all those books that you've mentioned. I probably have bought nearly every single book on writing, and I think I tried to use the Save the Cat one and I just couldn't get my head around it. I was just like, I just can't. It's just too, the more I feel like the more I try and forensically investigate the process, the harder it becomes. I think for me, I just need it to be a natural, organic thing, and then work with my editor to make it more structured. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I think you need to employ a third party structured brain who can see
exactly.
But it's more like homework then, isn't it?
And I feel like as well with some of these, there's a danger that people are writing for to a structure, and they're thinking about what's going to sell, and they're not thinking about the story they want to tell. They need to rewrite what comes from the heart, not you need to write this because it's going to save the cat or whatever it is that it's supposed to do.
For those of those who are unaware of it, it's Blake Snyder's Save the Cat, which was which is one of the seminal books. He was a Hollywood screenwriter, he's now passed away, but his it was about the Hollywood approach to structuring a story and then you have to hit
beats, don't you? Like have to hit those beats and stuff.
And that's a very common theme that now a lot of the structures talk about the beats. But you know, you can see that in a movie. There are certain moments, you know, the inciting incident at the beginning of the movie sets up the rest of the story. The halfway point, which is the point where everything, you know, can never be the same again, and the hero has to commit to seeing this through to the end with dire consequences three quarters of the way in, that it looks like everything's lost. And you know, so I've absorbed that much.
I think for some people it does work. They've got the ideas, but they need that structure to help them get it out. But for me, it doesn't work. I don't like to being told what to do. My brain tells me what to do. It's like, today we're going to write this.
But I think as a reader as well, you want to be told a story. You're reading it because you want to be told a story, and you don't necessarily want a story that ticks all the boxes of how a story should be. You want to feel the writer's emotion.
Exactly.
Well, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, you're writing psychological fiction, and that is a genre which is, I would suggest, is, and especially in domestic settings that we're dealing with here, a relatively new genre. I mean, sort of the thing that has dominated publishing for the last 5 or 6 years.
It has,
and probably been going for about 10. I mean, you know, you could probably look at sort of Patricia Cornwell or someone like, not Patricia Cornwell, I'm thinking of Highsmith, Patricia Highsmith, who did suspense books, and you know, you could probably retrofit that title onto her, some of hers.
Yeah. Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Yeah. But in terms of a thing, you know, there are certain reader expectations when people pick up a book with this, you know, your books have covers which are right on genre, if you don't mind me saying.
Yeah, definitely.
They pick it up and they have a certain expectation that they're going to get a girl on a train or, do you know what I mean? And therefore they have certain beats they're expecting to experience. I think a lot of readers are. But anyway, I'm putting it out there.
We're going to argue now because I don't think they are thinking, oh, it's going to have
I don't think they're conscious of the beats, but they're kind of expecting a certain structure of.
I think it's all to do with this twists thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Like all the advertising is twist you won't see coming. So they're waiting for a twist they won't see coming. So I think there's
Page
a
turning and put down of all gripping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're guilty of doing that too. I mean, you know.
But it works. So you've got to do what works, don't you?
Well, totally. I mean, there is a genre expectation on an Amazon blurb page for it to say, you know, full gripping and full of twists.
A twist you won't expect at the end. There always has to be.
But, you know, looking at that then, and your methodology, you know, if we can describe that, but, you know, the way that works for you, let's describe it that way. Does that way that you write, you know, following mood and jumping around within the arc of the story, does that naturally lend itself to creating those twists? Because you don't know what's coming next, you know, going to appear on the screen.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, because I don't know what I'm going to do. So yeah, so I'm kind of just as surprised. And yeah, I think it's. I tend to look at. I'm looking at emotions, and I'm thinking about I want to get this across, and then exciting things just seem to happen as I'm writing it. So yeah, I just I like to surprise myself as well. With that, so I try and write the book I would love to read. That's what I always try and do.
But do you think that that's a more natural twist then? Because sometimes you read a book and the unexpected twist comes and you think, oh yeah.
It does make it harder though, because obviously I've got to try and, like, because I'm making up as I go along. Sometimes you've got to be like, is that actually like exciting enough? Could I make this more exciting and things? So it can be a little bit hard to be objective when you know the end and you're like, how they're going to see this through. And then with the Save Her, like, a lot of people messaged me and said they couldn't have predicted the ending. I'm like, really? I thought it was really obvious, but that's because I knew I'd written it. So it's hard to be objective with twists and stuff like that sometimes.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You've got to trust yourself, I think.
Yeah.
Do you have to retrospectively put in red herrings or breadcrumb information that's going to be significant later on, because you've done it out of sequence?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, that's why my second edit takes so long, because I have to go back and just kind of connect it all and make sure it flows and stuff. And because I'm writing so out of sync and I'm absolutely useless at taking notes or anything, I'm very like, all I do is write, and then I have to spend ages like writing down everyone's hair color and then going back through and fixing it, because they've had like seven different hair colors as I've gone through, depending on what mood I'm in. So it's just, and everybody's name changes, because as we talked about before, I'm not very good at names. So I'm like, oh no, I don't like that name anymore, I'm going to change it. And so it does take me a lot longer, because I'm having to go back and kind of look for consistency, because I am not writing it in any order. So just are they still wearing that when they're doing that and stuff? And then obviously adding things to make my ending fit. So I'm probably doing it a very more stressful, long-winded way, but it's the only way that works for me. I can't do it any other way.
No, that's fascinating. In terms of the coming up with names, because that's something that I don't spend a lot of time doing it. When I'm sat there and I know I've got a character that I need to play a certain role, and you know at that stage it's not going to be a major one, but suddenly a name will just pop in and it works into my head, and I won't have gone through the phone book such as it is anymore, like people used to. I won't be looking at the bookshelf to look at all the names that could
that's a good fit. Idea
yeah it is a good one, isn't it?
Yeah, I used a random name generator on Scrivener, but then I get so distracted and spend ages looking up like Polish names for no reason whatsoever, just to see what they are. So it's it can be a bit of a wormhole, that.
Yeah, it's I sometimes think it's similar to the mood thing that you were talking about in terms of the type of name I'm going to come up with is going to suit the mood at the time. And then I have the debate, which is, am I going to refer to them by their surname throughout the book, or am I going to use their first name? Yeah. And then that's another conundrum. So then I start getting twisted about that. So
I have a funny story to do with names on The Good Husband. My mum is a nurse, and she works in a hospital, and she was telling me about one of her friends at the hospital. It's called Adina, and I was like, oh, I love that name, could I use it in my book? And so she asked her friend, and she was like, yeah, that's fine. So I was like, oh, this is brilliant. But then my mum spent the entire time going, hey, what are you doing to Adina? You can't hurt Adina. And you can't kill Adina. Like, you can't do anything bad to Adina, because she's my friend at work. Like, she's going to be really upset if you... And I'm like, mum, it's a psychological thriller. You did tell her that, right? Like, it's a thriller. Like, bad things happen in thrillers. So so I said, I'm never using anybody's name again that I know, because that was so stressful. She made me feel like really stressed, like... that with when I was writing, I had it in the back of my mind going, you can't do anything bad to Adina.
No, you can't.
It's funny though, because I think people actually quite like the idea of being the baddie or being murdered. So one of our authors ran a competition to provide the name of the woman who gets killed at the beginning of the book, and loads of people wanted either them or their wives or their mothers
to be
this person.
I'll have to use one of those next time then, because that was so stressful.
In terms of, you're saying quite rightly, it's a genre where bad things happen to people.
Yes.
How bad do they get? I mean, do you what?
I'm getting quite dark now. Yeah, I've started off quite like not that dark and quite reserved. And I think with Save Her, it's more of a, it's less dark than The Good Husband and the one I'm writing now. But with Save Her, I feel like it took me a long time to write it because it was with the first one, because a lot of it, it was my first one and it was quite raw. There was only two characters. It was very like simple, like, and it was quite raw. I think that's what had its appeal. So I got quite in my head with Save Her because I wanted to explore, challenge myself. So I wanted to have like a whole family and more characters. I wanted to set it somewhere I'd never lived. And but then I got a lot in my head, like, oh, are people not going to like this because it's not as raw as that one? And so I feel like I was really in my head and was writing for the reader, not for myself with that one a bit. And so I did struggle with that. Whereas with The Good Husband, I just went for it. I wrote what I wanted to write. I just went where it took me. And I didn't even want to think about like anything like that. And I really enjoyed writing the dark scenes, which I don't know what that says about me, because I thought they were the best things. Like I loved them. I was like, this is so exciting. But it has gone quite dark in The Good Husband, with like some of the things that he's got people like kneeling on rice and things to kind of like punish them. So there's quite a few things. And then with this one I'm doing, it seems to be quite like that as well. But I feel like that's what I enjoy writing now. Like I like to kind of go like write things like that. And that's like what I like to read as well. So
kneeling on rice.
It's really painful.
Yeah, but I do that all the time when I'm sweeping the kitchen floor.
Yeah, but then you see that would be the same as standing on Lego.
Oh, standing on Lego. Yes. That's too bad.
I'd walk across hot coals, but I wouldn't consider walking across a 20-foot length of Lego. No, that's not happening.
No. You've got two boys. You must have stood on lots of Lego. Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, absolutely. that's my swear words as a result of treading on Lego.
We had a cat who used to take the Lego out of the cat flap and leave it in the garden. I've got three boys. They used to get so cross. Because you go in the garden, you'd find like random Lego, bits of Lego all over the grass. That's very odd. I don't know why she did that.
Let's talk about cats. Because this program, we always talk about cats. And you've got two.
I do,
Now, it seems to me that we've got a number of authors who have cats as well. And they're actually very important to their creative process. Do your cats coming into do they do that thing of jumping in your lap while you're trying to type?
Oh, you're trying to type with a cat crawling, you know,
with
your
a tail
arms.
in front of your eyes.
Yeah, so they do that sometimes, but my cats are the reason I got a dog, because they don't love me anymore. They've got old. They just don't like, I'll be like Lulu and she'll just walk off in the opposite direction. She gives me this foul look and then just walks off. They've got really old and grumpy. So they occasionally will come and if I'm on the, they tend to do it if I'm doing anything by hand. My cats love pens. So if I've got a pen, then they're all over me. That's the only time I get any affection. They attack my pens. But no, they're quite, one of the Poppy, she just sleeps all the time. I'm not sure how she's not fat, because she just does nothing. She just sleeps all day, every day. But she's like super skinny. It's really unfair. And then Lulu, she just spends most of her time outside. But yeah, only if I get a pen that they're interested. So when I do like print it out, then they're all over me because they want to buy it.
Here's my theory, is that I think that I could write dark scenes much easier if the cat is glowering at me, because I was listening to a podcast the other week about, it's the Rest Is History podcast, one of the most popular in the country. And they were talking about the persecution of the Cathars down in the Carcassonne Languedoc area of France, of this sort of Catholic Church pogrom against people who were regarded as heretics. And one of the things that they used to put out there as a piece of disinformation, you know, the false news or whatever, of a medieval variety, was that the Cathars would kiss the bottom of a cat, because that cats were the animals of Satan, and this was the way to commune with the devil. And I kind of get that with our cat occasionally, that she can sour my mood very, very quickly and put me in that place where I'm doing evil things to evil people, to good people,
like me
in writing. Yeah, no. And indeed in life. I don't know. I don't know if that
resonates at all.
You have a very odd relationship with the cat. He has a very strong love hate. Mm. So he either hates her. Like this morning, got to wash the bedding because the cat has been on it for 10 minutes.
Oh, right.
She's asking for food, but she's got food. Cat. But when she went missing during lockdown. She got stuck up a tree, but we didn't know it to start with. She just went missing. He was distraught.
Yeah. Yeah, I do love my cats. I wish they were just more cuddly. We used to have two male cats and you could literally pick Bobby up by his back legs and he wouldn't care. Like, you could just manhandle him. But look, Poppy and Lulu, they're so, like, you can't pick them up. They have to come to you. It's all on their terms. It's very frustrating.
I think that's a female-male thing, though.
And they bully me as well. Me and Jamie will just be walking by and then all of a sudden Lulu's paw will just come out and she'll go whoosh, and just hit us with her paw, like, as we're walking past. Like, how dare you walk down this corridor?
Wow.
So yeah, they're not as I think it's age, maybe they've just got really grumpy in their old age because they are like 8 now, so they are quite old ladies, but yeah, they've just got really grumpy.
Yeah, well,
our cat, what's she, 14?
14, yeah,
she is very grumpy.
Grumpy cat. So tell us about the dog. That's Ozzy Osbourne.
He's the reason, like, because obviously the cats weren't cuddling me and I had to isolate in all of lockdown. I couldn't even go do the shopping or anything. So we got him during the lockdown and I actually was terrified of dogs. I was a massive cat person and it's my husband that's always wanted one. And then with the pandemic, his job and my job have both gone permanently from home. So I finally said, right, okay, let's try. So we got a puppy and it's the best thing I've ever done. He's my best friend. It's great. It's lovely.
Yeah, and I think I'm due to see my diabetic specialist and I'm sure she said, get a dog so you're out there exercising every day.
Yeah, just help for that.
Our neighbours have got one. We can do.
He's really good with the cats as well, which is good because we did loads of research on what breeds were good with a cat because we didn't want obviously him to annoy the cats, but they're really good with him, to be fair. Lulu bullies him, if anything. She sits halfway upstairs so he can't come up because if he comes up, she'll hit him. So she's she rules the roost in this house, Lulu, to be honest.
That's a good idea.
Okay, Cavapoo it is then.
Yeah.
No,
that's fascinating. And I wanted, you know, as spawn business owners, we wanted to touch on this because you've written about how challenging it is. No one tells you just how demanding it's going to be and how all-consuming it is, and that, you know, we say amen to that because I was in a traditional, you know, public service sector job in the BBC 25 years and now running our own business, and I just didn't expect it to be 24/7 like it is.
It's so hard, and that's, again, I published The Puppet Master in 2016 or 15, oh god, my brain, and then I didn't actually publish Save Her until it took me 3 years because I opened my own business because I thought, oh, I was a centre manager as a company, but I had no time for writing. So I thought, well, if I go freelance and run my own business, I'll have loads of time to write. That is not the case. That fear about where your next paycheck is going to come from dominates your entire life. And the fact that you just can't switch off. Like, I tried everything. I've got a work phone, and so I don't have everything on my personal phone, but then somehow my work phone goes everywhere with me, so that was pointless. Like, it is so hard to run your own business. It is hard, and even as an author as well, to try and make money as being an author is incredibly difficult because it is such a saturated market and it's real hard to make a big splash. So it's going to take a while for me to be able to earn enough money that I could pull back on my other business. But yeah, it is really difficult to run your own business. But I've got better work-life balance now. I've really worked on myself and what's important to me. And so I carve out time for my writing now, and I will pull back on my other job and not let it consume me as much as it did. I'm trying to remind myself a lot that this is what I want to do, so I need to invest time in it. So I have like protected time for writing now, which I never had before.
And how does your husband deal with that?
In what way? Just,
well, it's you know, because carving out time means you're, you know, in a way, personally, whenever I would feel that way about, you know, I've got to carve out some time to do writing or whatever it might be, it feels, you know, part of me is feeling I'm being a bit selfish here.
Yeah.
I mean, because it feels, you know, if you flip it around, you can see it as being a little self-indulgent. It's not actually running a business. It's not making, you know, it's not something.
Yeah.
But it's something less tangible.
Yeah. I think he just knows how hungry I am for it. So he is actually really supportive, to be fair, with that. And luckily with my business, it is doing really well. So I can, financially, it doesn't hit us if I pull back. He's absolutely massively into video games. So he's quite happy when I go off to surprise him, because it means he can play video games without me moaning for attention. So
that's true.
He's like, didn't you have some writing to do?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's a good balance.
Does he read your books?
No, so this is a bone of contention. So I didn't mind at first, because he has very severe dyslexia, so he doesn't read really. He'll do audiobooks every now and then, but his preferred genre is sci-fi. So he won't watch any crime dramas or anything with me. Because of that, that's his preferred genre. So he hasn't read them. They're not in audiobook at the moment. I think that's in progress. So he couldn't really listen to them. So I've kind of let him off. But I'm getting to the stage now where I'm like, I think you could just maybe read at least one of them, maybe.
Perhaps you could read them to him.
So we do have that
conversation. Yeah, you could read them to him.
No, I could never do that. No, could never do that. The thing is, I don't know if you know, I cannot read my books, because I'll just be like, I tried it. I had to do a reading and I wanted to change everything. I was like, I could have worded that so much better. So I would just be preoccupied by that. I wouldn't be able to.
When you're doing the edit and rereading stuff, I'm going to just kill Rebecca's bike phone. She's got a cold at the moment.
Oh, bless her.
And I shall carry on. But in terms of, you all right, love? Do you ever read aloud when you're writing? Because I find that incredibly useful.
Yeah, this is something I've recently learned. I find it so cringy, but I have, from my last edits, I realised I am absolutely ridiculous at using the same word. I think, and I also like to rhyme and I don't realise. So I think I'd written something like, she fell through the door onto the floor. And stuff, and it's just lots of rhyming. And then I was trying to describe somebody having their face right next to someone else, and I was like, he had his nose next to his nose so that their noses were nose to nose. And I was like, so, and I hadn't even twigged until I got the edits back. And then so for this edit, I am actually reading it aloud to myself, and I normally use a Mac, but the Windows read aloud, the voice actually does intonation now. So it sounds like an actual person. So I'm using that to read aloud, because she sounds more human than any, because obviously I know all the software and stuff can read aloud to you through my job. But she's got the best voice out of all of them, and it's free in the read aloud in Word. If you've got the Windows 11, and she sounds amazing. So I'm actually using her, or else sometimes if I'm on my own, I'll read it aloud. But yeah, I did not realize how useful that was until recently. And it's made a huge difference and tightens it up, because you can be quite wordy, can't you? But when you read it out loud, you automatically shorten it, don't you? So it helps to with that. And also you notice when you're rhyming and using the same word seven times.
My heart's fallen through the floor as a narrator that now read aloud is effective as well.
No, don't
it's
worry.
Not like it's still robotic, but and it's, it yeah, will never no, be human, mean. But it is more impressive than a lot of the ones out there, to be fair.
Sure enough. Right. I think it is time, Abby, for us to get to the moment of the week. Highlight for many people, I feel.
Low light for many people, too.
Probably. And that, of course, is Rebecca's random question.
Love it.
Okay, so it was Valentine's Day this week. So my question relates to Valentine's Day. Have you ever had an anonymous Valentine's card that you've never found out who it's from?
I haven't. I don't wish I had, because I would want to know, and it would plague me for the rest of my life that I wouldn't know. That would drive me to distraction. So I'm quite glad actually that I haven't. But no, I haven't had a Valentine's Day card. But my husband did get something through the post this week. It was like a bag full of, looked like turmeric powder in a jiffy bag. This is so strange, right? So it was addressed to him, and inside this jiffy bag, this envelope, you know, like a padded envelope, was just this clear plastic baggie with a tissue covered in this orange powder. And we don't know, and there was no note and the powder didn't smell of anything, because I thought maybe it was turmeric, but it didn't smell of spice or anything. So that was really weird. And then the next day he got a card through the post, and it said, it was a card and it had Merry Christmas on it, and no writing on it in the card, just Merry Christmas printed on it, and all that powder again through the post. So that's his Valentine's. He's got some stalker out there. We have no idea who sent this to him and why. There's no note, nothing. Like, it was really
That's creepy.
Like, I could understand if they'd sent it to you. You write all those crazy books. I was like, oh, thank you. Thanks. So how weird is that? And we have no idea. And we're actually dreading the post every day now. Luckily, we didn't get anything yesterday. So hopefully they've stopped now. But it is so weird. We have no idea what the powder was and who sent it, because there was no note. But it went from being, it was weird when we got the first one. But then when we got the second one with the card, that was creepy. Christmas. Yeah. And the postmark said they'd sent it on the 11th of February. So it's very bizarre.
To quote Sir Michael Caine, you can use the difficulty, and this feels like the inspiration for your next book.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, but it was just a bit of a weird one. Like, why would you just send some orange powder to someone? It just makes no sense to me. I don't think anyone would believe it in a book.
No, because it's just too random and bizarre.
Isn't it? Like, it's so funny that things in life you couldn't actually put in a book, could you? Because nobody would believe it.
Yeah, that is weird.
But yeah.
Have you ever had an anonymous Valentine's
Day? Do you remember? I mean, when I finally went to a mixed school at 16, having been in an old boys' school, I mean, because clearly that wasn't relevant. We didn't give each other Valentine's too often, especially in the 80s where, you know, everyone was homophobic.
Yes, no, definitely not.
When I went to sixth form college, there was this thing. We used to have the proverbial letterbox thing that you put your Valentine's in and it would get distributed around. And I think the most I ever got was three.
That's impressive.
You know, there were some blokes getting 20, 25 cards, wow. And you were thinking, wow, geez, what?
I lived up in Cumbria. It wasn't really a big deal up there.
I think it's a very Cambridge phenomenon in terms of, and they were very, and the ones I got were incredibly artistic in terms of, you know, someone had gone to the trouble of writing, you know, nice poems or something like that.
That's nice.
Putting some carefully chosen Shakespeare aphorisms in there or something like that. You know, you're thinking, oh my God, how pseudo is this person? I don't think I really want to know who she is.
I'm not very good at being sentimental. My cards are things like, I said, I got Jamie one that says that if you were eaten by a dinosaur, I'd miss you. I'm not very good at being sentimental. I go for the funny ones all the time.
Yeah.
Well, his for me had a cat's bottom on it with a heart. And this is before I knew about the devil worship thing.
I gave you a card this, and I went to a lot of trouble because I actually, you know, I don't like to make I'm not a crafty person, but I did this week.
Yeah, he made me a Valentine's card with glitter and everything.
Oh,
and plectrums.
And plectrums. Nice.
Guitar
plectrums
to make a flower.
Oh, that's so
that's
lovely.
Cute. At least
my husband doesn't believe in Valentine's Day. So I said, you've got to get me something for Valentine's Day. So I put something on my phone. I put a necklace in the basket and then I used his finger to press pay now. So I think that counts as him getting me a Valentine's Day present.
I love that.
That is superb.
I should try that.
That is absolutely brilliant. Well, tell us what we can expect next from you, writing wise. You've said
So The Good Husband was published last year, and right. So my next one, I've just finished the edit for, so I'm submitting that to my publisher on the 27th of February, and that should be published in I think July, August time, hopefully. So hopefully that will be and it's another psychological thriller, I have a name, but I'm not very good at names, as I've said a few times, so normally gets changed. So I'm not sure what the name will be at the moment, but this one's quite actiony, because I was concerned with The Good Husband that it was a few of the reviews said, oh, it was quite slow to get started. So I was like, right, I will remedy that. So this one, it's quite action based. So it follows a man whose wife has been kidnapped. So it's just like trying to work out who's behind it and stuff like that. So that's what that one is about. So it's more of, I would say it's probably kind of an action-based psychological thriller, this one. I've really tried to ramp up the tension from page one with this.
Fantastic, fantastic. And if people want to find out more about you as an author, where should they go online?
So my website is abigailosborne.co.uk, and I have a newsletter sign up on there if anybody wants to sign up to that. I also give away a free copy of one of my books on ebook every month to one of my subscribers. And then obviously my books are on Amazon if they wanted to look at the books as well. And I'm very present on TikTok if you want some funny laughs, some funny videos. There's some funny videos on there that I do.
Oh, we'll have to follow you then, because we're sort of passively on TikTok, aren't we?
We are a bit, yeah.
I like it.
I had a bit of a flurry about a year ago, but
yeah,
and I can get quite addicted to watching it.
Yeah, I think it's just like with TikTok, you can just be yourself, and whereas with Instagram, you have to have a nice picture, and I'm not very good at pictures, and I can't think of anything nice to take. Whereas with TikTok, you can just be you, do random things, and it's really good fun. Top tip for you: everybody on TikTok loves food, so my best videos are the ones where I've gone for every 500 words I write, I get one of these, and then I pan the camera to some Viennese whirls. And that video went nuts. Everybody loved it. So that's the top tip for you if you're using TikTok. Food is the way to people's heart.
Fabulous.
It always has been, really, hasn't it?
Yeah,
fabulous. It is, well, yeah. You know, that's a great takeaway for everybody. And Abby, it's been an absolute pleasure. We've really enjoyed it. Thank you so
much. I've really enjoyed it too. Thank you for having me.
And it won't surprise you that we got on so well. We spoke to you, Abby, for about 45 minutes extra.
I know. We just carried on talking, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We did. We just had so much in common and just that great feeling. And I love our interviews for doing that, because every time we speak to somebody new that we've not met before, there is that element of building a rapport.
Yeah.
And a sense that we've got another kindred spirit in the industry.
And we know we're going to meet up with Abby because she'll be at Harrogate. So we're bound to bump into her and...
Yep.
And I think actually when we go to Harrogate, by the time Harrogate comes around, because a lot of the people we've spoken to are planning on going there, we could have three tables worth of...
Oh yeah, I can't wait. I mean, the contrast to when we first went to Harrogate and didn't know anybody,
yeah,
and felt like fish out of water and all that sort of thing. What a contrast now.
Yeah, so, it'd be completely, you know, different.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, you know, equally... For those people who felt the same, will be feeling the same way that first Harrogate, we've got to, you know, be embracive, you know, and bring people in to the tent, if you like, you know, metaphorically and for real. We're taking a little bit of a break from life in the barn. So the cat is going to be well looked after.
My Newport Pet Services.
Yeah, absolutely. We have the kids are currently with their dad.
They're actually in London at the moment.
Are they? Yeah. And so they're there for the week. It's half term. We're off to Sussex to Rye. We have hired a little cottage. So we're going to do coastal walks, pubs and read.
Guitar playing.
Yes, with a guitar playing and an absolute mass of submissions that we've had over the last 2 weeks, totaling so far over 40.
42 to be exact, we've had.
42.
Yes.
And well, that's the, you know, Douglas Adams number, isn't it?
Indeed.
So we're looking forward to that. That'll be...
The meaning of life.
That will be quite a challenge, actually, because reading that many submissions, that's a lot of reading.
Well, yes, but I think we could do it because we're not reading a whole book. We're not reading 42 books. We're reading the first three chapters of these books. So I'm looking forward to it because in our day-to-day life, it's hard to get to submissions because of all the distractions and the noise and all the other things we have to do.
Yeah.
The whole point of having this holiday is we can focus on these submissions and get a real feel for them.
Yes.
Rather than
And
sort of
when you're
impression.
Out of your normal context, it's much easier to concentrate on something like that, I think.
So if you submitted to us,
yeah,
that's what we'll be doing. We'll be reading your submission.
And a matter of just a few hours ago, we made a big, a big change. We launched an adjunct to Hoebeck Books. So Hoebeck Books, as you know, publishers of four genres of particular crime fiction.
Yeah.
But alongside that, we do a lot of freelance work, and that's really what pays the bills, keeps the roof over our heads and all that sort of thing. And we've decided that we would create an adjunct to Hoebeck Books called Arch Publishing Service, publishing services, I should say. And so the website went live this morning. We've let everyone know in the Hoback family that that's what we're doing. And it is basically sort of an umbrella for that work and hopefully developing more work in that way. So that if you've got a book that needs any type of development work or advice on how to get it published or typeset or book trailers for it, the audiobook, you name it, we do pretty much all of it. And this is for sort of private clients who want to get their books out for whatever reason. So we've done a project recently called Transformational Selling with two guys who are world experts in selling from business to business. And they had this dream of creating a book and the whole shebang, which supports their wider business. And we've done that.
Yeah. So we could do as much or as little as required for each particular client who comes to us. Because some people might just want typesetting of the interior. Because I've joined a lot of Facebook groups recently, self-publishing support groups. And that is quite a common theme, actually. People are saying, you know, I've got a designer for my cover and I've got my KDP dashboard ready, but how do I format the book?
Yeah. Well, we can do that for you. Yeah. There's so many things we can turn our hands to, as we've learned through Hoback and your previous work in publishing and obviously my broadcast background. So lots and lots of things on offer. It's all there on the website. And the website is www.archpub.net. Check it out.
Yes, do take a look.
Please. Yeah, absolutely. We're very proud of it. And we're you know, it is, as I say, a way of sort of formally creating an umbrella brackets around the freelance element of our working lives. And we'll use the resources obviously to support ourselves, but also continue to develop Hoback books. So that's terrific. And in terms of Hoback, check out our website, www.hoback.net. Check out the audiobooks there too. We have our own storefront for audiobooks and for our paperbacks as well. We would love you to take a good look there, read about our authors and all our news.
And also please follow us on TikTok, because I've just posted a very good video of the cat.
Yes, you have. Yes, it was a work of creative and comic genius. Anyway, we will continue to fight the good fight, and I'm sure you'll join us regularly here on the Hobcast Book Show. We do appreciate your support. At some point in the near future, we're going to move platforms. So you'll still be able to get it where you get it now, but we'll use a different provider to provide the overall sort of technical support for the web, for the podcast. You know, we think it's time to make a move to something a little bit more advanced. Anyway, more about that at some point in the future. I haven't quite got around to doing it.
But, it's on his list.
It's on my list. It's on my list. As is saying thank you for joining us. My name's been Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And we'd like to wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hoback Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hoback.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.